and tore open her robe, tore away the cambric which covered her shoulder, and, crimsoned by pretended rage and simulated shame, exposed to the young man the ineffaceable mark which dishonored that beautiful shoulder. "But," exclaimed Felton, "it is a fleur-de-lis that I see." "And in that consists the greater infamy," replied her ladyship. "The brand of England would have made it necessary for him to prove from what court the sentence had been issued, and I should have made a public appeal to all the tribunals of the realm. But the brand of France, oh, by that I was indeed branded." It was more than Felton could endure. Pale, motionless, petrified by this frightful revelation, dazzled by the superhuman loveliness of that woman, who unveiled herself before him with an immodesty which appeared to him sublime, he fell upon his knees before her, as did the first Christians before those pure and holy martyrs whom the persecution of the emperors delivered in the circus to the sanguinary violators of the mob. The mark of infamy disappeared. The beauty alone remained. "Forgive me! Forgive me!" exclaimed Felton. "Oh, forgive me!" Her ladyship read in his eyes, "Love, love."
"Forgive you? For what?"
she inquired.
"Forgive me for uniting myself with your oppressors."
Her ladyship held out her hand.
"So beautiful, so young!"
exclaimed Felton, covering that hand with kisses. Her ladyship cast upon him one of those glances which convert the slave into a monarch. Felton, Puritan as he was, relinquished her hand to kiss her feet. He had before violently loved. He now adored her. When this crisis had passed over, when her ladyship appeared to have resumed the calmness she had never really lost,
"Ah," said he, "I have now only one thing more to ask of you. It is the name of your true executioner. For in my opinion there was only one. The other was an instrument, nothing more."
"Brother,"
exclaimed her ladyship,
"can it be necessary for me now to tell his name? Have you not already guessed it?"
"What?"
resumed Felton.
"Him? Again him? What, the true criminal?"
"The true criminal," said her ladyship, "is the plunderer of England, the persecutor of all true believers, the cowardly destroyer of woman's honor. He who, for a caprice of his polluted heart, is about to shed so much of England's blood, who protects the Protestants today and tomorrow will betray them."
"Buckingham! It is indeed Buckingham, then!" exclaimed the exasperated Felton.
Her ladyship hid her face in her hands, as if she was unable to endure the shame which that name recalled.
"Buckingham, the violator of this angelic creature!" exclaimed Felton. "And thou, O God, hast not smitten him? Thou hast left him noble, honored, powerful for the destruction of us all!
God abandons him who ceases to be constant to himself," said her ladyship.
"But surely he must wish to draw down upon himself the chastisement reserved for the accursed," continued Felton, with increasing excitement. "Surely he must wish that human vengeance should anticipate the chastisement of heaven."
"Yet men fear and spare him."
"Oh," exclaimed Felton, "I fear him not. Neither will I spare him."
Her ladyship felt her heart bathed in a flood of infernal joy.
"But how," continued Felton, "does Lord de Winter, my protector, my father, come to be concerned in this?"
"Listen, Felton," replied her ladyship. "By the side of the cowardly and contemptible, there are always men of noble, generous natures. I was betrothed to a man whom I loved and who loved me. A heart like yours, Felton, a man like you. I went to him and told him what had taken place. He knew the Duke well and did not entertain a moment's doubt. He was a nobleman, a man equal in every respect to Buckingham. He spoke not, but he girded on his sword, wrapped his cloak around him, and proceeded to the palace of the Duke."
"Yes, yes," said Felton, "I understand. Yet with such men it is not the sword that should be used, but the dagger."
"Buckingham had departed on the previous evening, on an embassy to the court of Spain, where he went to demand the hand of the Infanta for King Charles I, then Prince of Wales. My lover returned. 'Listen,' said he, 'this man is gone, and consequently for the present he escapes my vengeance. But in the meantime, let us be united as we ought to be, and then depend on Lord de Winter to support his own honour and the honour of his wife.'"
"Lord de Winter!" exclaimed Felton.
"Yes," said her ladyship. "Lord de Winter. And now you understand it all, do you not? Buckingham remained absent nearly a year. 8 days before his return, Lord de Winter died suddenly, leaving me his sole heiress. Whence came this blow? God, who sees everything, doubtless knows. As for me, I accuse nobody."
"Oh, what an abyss! What an abyss!" exclaimed Felton.
Lord de Winter had died without confiding in his brother. The terrible secret was to have been concealed from everyone until it burst like thunder on the head of the guilty duke. Your protector had seen with pain this marriage of his brother with a young and dowerless girl, and I perceived that I could expect no assistance from a man who was disappointed in his hopes of an inheritance. I went to France, resolved to remain there for the remainder of my life. But my whole fortune was in England, and all communications being stopped by the war, I was in want of everything, and was, in fact, compelled to return. 6 days ago I arrived at Portsmouth.
Well, said Felton.
Well, Buckingham had unquestionably been apprised of my return, and announced it to Lord de Winter, who was already prejudiced against me, and at the same time he persuaded him that his sister-in-law was a dissolute and branded woman. The pure and noble voice of my husband was no longer there to defend me. Lord de Winter no doubt believed all that he heard, and the more readily, because it was to his interest to believe it. Hence he caused me to be arrested, conveyed here, and placed under your charge. You know the sequel. The day after tomorrow he sends me forth amongst the infamous. Oh, the woof is well woven, the plot is skilfully planned, and my honour will perish in it. You see, Felton, that I must die. Felton, give me the knife.
At these words, as if all her strength was exhausted, her ladyship sank, weak and languishing, into the arms of the young officer.
No, no, said he. No, you shall live. You shall live, honored and pure. You shall live to triumph over your enemies.
Her ladyship gently forced him back with her hand, whilst she attracted him by her look.
Oh, death, death, said she, lowering her eyelids and her voice. Death rather than disgrace, Felton. My brother, my friend, I implore you.
No, exclaimed Felton. No, you shall live, and you shall be avenged.
Felton, I bring misfortune upon everything that surrounds me. Felton, desert me. Let me die.
Well, then, let us die together, exclaimed he. Several knocks sounded on the door.
Listen, said she. We have been overheard. They come, and it is all over. We are undone.
No, said Felton. It is the sentinel who merely lets me know that the guard is about to be changed.
Hasten, then, to the door and open it yourself.
Felton obeyed her. This woman already wholly engrossed his thoughts. She was already mistress of all his soul. On opening the door, he found himself confronted by a sergeant who commanded a patrol of the guard.
Well, what is the matter? Demanded the young lieutenant.
You told me, replied the sentinel, to open the door if I heard you call for help, but you forgot to leave me the key. I heard you cry out without knowing what you said. I tried to open the door, but it was fastened inside, and therefore I called the sergeant. And here I am, said the sergeant.
Felton, wandering, wild, verging upon madness, remained speechless. Her ladyship saw at once that she must relieve him from this embarrassment. She ran to the table and seized the knife which he had placed there.
And by what right would you prevent my death? Said she.
Great God! Exclaimed Felton, as he saw the knife glittering in her hand.
At this moment a burst of ironical laughter resounded down the corridor. The Baron, attracted by the noise, stood in his dressing gown and with his sword under his arm upon the threshold of the door.
Ah! Ah! Said he. Here we are at the last act of the tragedy. You see, Felton, the drama has presented all the phases that I indicated. But don't concern yourself. No blood will be spilled.
Her ladyship felt that she was ruined unless she gave to Felton an immediate and terrible proof of her courage.
You deceive yourself, my lord. Blood will be spilled, and may that blood return on those who cause it to flow.
Felton uttered a cry and rushed towards her, but he was too late. She had dealt the blow. The knife had, however, fortunately, we ought to say skillfully, encountered the steel busk,
by which, as by a cuirass, the chests of women were at that period defended, and, glancing aside, had torn the robe and penetrated diagonally between the flesh and the ribs. The lady's dress was, nevertheless, instantaneously stained with blood, and she fell back, apparently insensible. Felton snatched away the knife. "See, my lord," said he, with a gloomy look, "this woman who was under my guard has slain herself." "Make yourself easy, Felton," replied Lord de Winter. "She is not dead. Demons do not die so simply. Make yourself easy, and go and wait for me in my apartment. But, my lord, go, I command you." This order from his superior, Felton obeyed. But as he went out, he placed the knife in his bosom. As for Lord de Winter, he contented himself with summoning the woman who waited upon her ladyship. And when she came, having recommended the prisoner, who was still insensible, to her care, he left them together. Nevertheless, as the wound might, after all, in spite of his suspicions, be really serious, he immediately dispatched a man on horseback for a surgeon. 58. The Escape. As Lord de Winter had suspected, her ladyship was not very dangerously wounded. As soon, therefore, as she found herself alone with the attendant whom the Baron had summoned, and who hastened to undress her, she opened her eyes. It was, however, necessary to counterfeit weakness and pain, and to an actress like her ladyship this was no difficult matter. So completely, indeed, was the poor woman the dupe of her prisoner, that against her entreaties she persisted in watching over her throughout the night. But the presence of this woman was no impediment to her ladyship's thoughts. There could be no longer any doubt that Felton was converted, that Felton was hers, and that had an angel appeared to the young man to accuse her, he would certainly have taken him, in his present state of mind, for an envoy of the evil one. Her ladyship smiled at this idea, for Felton was henceforth her only hope, her sole means of safety. Yet Lord de Winter might have suspected him, and Felton might now perhaps himself be watched. About 4 o'clock in the morning the surgeon arrived, but her ladyship's wound had already closed. He therefore could determine neither its direction nor its depth, but from the pulse of his patient he concluded that the case was not very serious. In the morning, under the pretense that she had not slept during the night, and had need of repose, her ladyship dismissed the woman who had watched beside her bed. She entertained a hope that Felton would visit her at breakfast-time, but Felton came not. Had her secret fears, then, been realized? Had Felton become suspected by the Baron, and would he fail her now, at the decisive moment? She had only one day remaining. Lord de Winter had fixed her embarkation for the 23rd, and this was the morning of the 22nd. Nevertheless, she still waited in tolerable patience till the hour of dinner. Although she had eaten nothing in the morning, her dinner was brought to her at the usual time, and her ladyship then perceived with alarm that the uniform of the soldiers who guarded her was different. She hazarded a question as to what had become of Felton. The answer was that Felton had departed on horseback an hour before. She inquired whether the Baron was still at the castle, and the soldier replied that he was, and had ordered him to let him know if the prisoner should express a wish to speak to him. Her ladyship said she was too weak at present, and that her only wish was to remain alone. The soldier then quitted the room, leaving the dinner served on the table. Felton, then, had been sent away, and the marines who guarded her were changed. It was obvious, therefore, that Felton was suspected. This was the last blow inflicted on the prisoner. As soon as she was left alone, her ladyship arose. That bed, to which she had confined herself in order that it might be thought her wound was serious, scorched her like a glowing furnace. She cast a glance at the door. A board had been nailed over the wicket. The Baron, no doubt, feared that she might, through this opening, still find some diabolical means of seducing her guards. Her ladyship smiled with joy. She could now give way to her emotions without observation. She roamed about her chamber with all the violence of a raving lunatic or a tigress imprisoned in her iron cage. Had the knife still been there, she would certainly have resolved to kill not herself, but the Baron. At 6 o'clock Lord de Winter entered. He was armed to the very teeth. This man, in whom her ladyship had hitherto seen only an elegant and polished gentleman, had now become an inexorable jailer. He seemed to expect everything, to conjecture everything, to anticipate everything.
A single glance at her ladyship told him what was passing in her soul. "So," said he, "you will not kill me today, for you are without a weapon, and, moreover, I am on my guard. You had begun to corrupt my poor Felton. He has already felt your infernal influence, but I wish to save him, and you shall see him no more. It is all ended now. You may pack your clothes, for tomorrow you will set out. I had fixed the embarkation for the 24th, but I have reflected that the sooner it takes place, the surer it will be. By 12 o'clock tomorrow, I shall receive the order for your banishment, signed by Buckingham. If you say one single word to anyone whatever before you are on board the vessel, my sergeant will blow out your brains. He has received his orders to do so. If, when on board, you speak to anyone without the captain's permission, the captain will have you cast into the sea. This is all determined on. And now, farewell till our next meeting. I have nothing more to say to you today. I shall see you again tomorrow, to take leave of you." At these words, the Baron left the room. Her ladyship had listened to this threatening tirade with a smile of scorn upon her lips, but with fury in her heart. The supper was brought in. Her ladyship felt that she needed strength, for she knew not what might be the events of that night, which was now approaching in gloom. Huge clouds were already careering in the skies, and distant flashes announced a tempest. About 10 o'clock the storm burst forth, and her ladyship found some consolation in seeing nature partake of the commotion in her own breast. The thunder bellowed in the air like the angry passions in her soul, and it seemed to her as if the passing gusts disturbed her brow, as they did the trees of which they bent down the branches and swept off the leaves. She howled like the tempest, but her voice was unheard amidst the vast voice of nature, which also appeared to be herself groaning in despair. From time to time she looked at a ring which she wore upon her finger. The bezel of this ring contained a subtle and violent poison. This was her last resource. Suddenly she heard something strike the window, and by the light of the gleaming flash she saw the countenance of a man appear behind its bars. She ran to the window and opened it. "Felton!" she exclaimed. "I am saved!" "Yes," said Felton, "but silence, silence! I must have time to file your bars. Only be careful that we are not perceived through the wicket." "Oh, it is a token that the Lord is on our side, Felton," replied her ladyship. "They have closed up the wicket with a board." "Good," said Felton. "Our God has deprived them of their senses." "But what must I do?" inquired her ladyship. "Nothing, nothing. Only shut your window. Go to bed, or at least lie down with your clothes on, and when I have finished, I will tap upon the glass. But will you be able to accompany me?" "Oh, yes, but your wound." "It pains me, but does not prevent me walking." "Be ready, then, at the first signal." Her ladyship closed the window, put out her lamp as Felton had advised, and threw herself upon the bed. Amidst the raging of the storm, she heard the grating of the file against the bars, and by the light of every flash she beheld the form of Felton behind the glass. She passed an hour in almost breathless suspense. Icy drops stood upon her brow, and at every sound that issued from the corridor, her heart was convulsed with frightful agony. There are hours which seem prolonged into years. At the expiration of this time, Felton again tapped. Her ladyship bounded from her bed and opened the window. The removal of two bars had formed an opening large enough to admit a man. "Are you ready?" demanded Felton.
"Yes. Must I carry anything away with me?"
"Money, if you have any."
"Fortunately, they have left me what I had."
"So much the better, for I have used all mine in chartering a vessel."
"Here,"
said her ladyship, placing in Felton's hand a bag of gold. Felton took the bag and threw it to the foot of the wall.
"Now,"
said he, "will you come?"
"Here I am."
Her ladyship mounted on a chair and passed the upper part of her body through the window. She saw the young officer suspended over the abyss by a ladder of ropes. For the first time, a sentiment of fear reminded her that she was a woman. The void terrified her. "I was afraid you would be terrified," said Felton.
"It is nothing. It is nothing," exclaimed her ladyship. "I will descend with my eyes shut."
"Have you confidence in me?" said Felton.
"Need you ask me?"
"Then put your two hands together and cross them." "That's right." Felton fastened the two wrists with his handkerchief, and then bound a cord above the handkerchief.
"What are you doing?"
demanded her ladyship in surprise. "Place your arms round my neck, and
do not be afraid.
But I shall make you lose your balance, and we shall both be dashed to pieces.
Do not alarm yourself. I am a sailor. There was not a moment to be lost. Her ladyship passed her arms around Felton's neck and allowed herself to glide through the window. Felton began to descend the ladder slowly, step by step. In spite of the weight of the two bodies, the blast of the hurricane swung them in the air. Suddenly Felton paused.
"What is the matter?" demanded her ladyship.
"Silence," said Felton. "I hear footsteps."
"We are discovered."
There was silence for a few moments. "No," said Felton. "It is nothing."
"But what is that noise?"
"It is the patrol, who are about to pass on their round."
"And which way do they go?"
"Immediately beneath us."
"Then we shall be discovered."
"No, if there should be no lightning."
"They will strike against the bottom of the ladder."
"Fortunately, it is too short by 6 feet."
"There they are! My God!"
"Silence!" They both remained suspended, motionless, and scarcely even venturing to breathe, at a height of 20 feet in the air, whilst the soldiers passed beneath them, laughing and talking. It was a fearful moment for the fugitives. The patrol passed by. They heard the sound of their retreating steps and the murmur of their voices, which became gradually weaker in the distance. "Now," said Felton, "we are saved." Her ladyship breathed a sigh and fainted. Felton continued to descend. Having reached the bottom of the ladder and finding no further support for his feet, he now descended by his hands until he clung to the last step, when, suspending himself by the strength of his wrists, he found that his feet touched the ground. He picked up the bag of gold, which he took between his teeth, and raising her ladyship in his arms, retreated rapidly in a direction opposite to that which the patrol had taken. Leaving the circuit of the guard, he plunged down amidst the rocks, and when he had reached the seashore, he whistled. His signal was replied to in a similar manner, and in 5 minutes afterwards, a boat appeared, manned by 4 men. The boat approached the shore, but there was too great a depth of water for it to be grounded. Felton waded into the sea up to his waist, not wishing to entrust his precious burden to any other hands. Fortunately, the tempest was beginning to abate, although the sea was still violent. The little boat bounded on the waves like a nutshell. "To the sloop," said Felton, "and pull quickly." The 4 men bent themselves to their work, but the sea was too heavy for their oars to make much way. Nevertheless, they began to leave the castle behind them, and that was the principal point. The night was profoundly dark, and it was already almost impossible for them to perceive the shore, much less could anyone upon the shore be able to perceive their boat. A black speck was rocking on the sea. It was the sloop. Whilst the boat was advancing towards it with all the force of its 4 rowers, Felton unbound the cord and the handkerchief which confined her ladyship's hands. Then, when these were once more at liberty, he took some seawater and sprinkled it upon her face. Her ladyship heaved a sigh and opened her eyes.
"Where am I?"
said she. "Saved," replied the young officer.
"Oh, saved! Saved!" exclaimed she. "Yes, I see the heavens and the ocean. This air which I breathe is that of liberty. Oh, thanks, Felton, thanks!"
The young man pressed her to his heart.
"But what is the matter with my hands?" asked her ladyship. "My wrists feel as though they have been crushed in a vice."
She lifted up her arms. Her wrists were indeed horribly lacerated. "Alas," said Felton, looking at those beautiful hands with a melancholy shake of the head.
"Oh, it is nothing, it is nothing!" exclaimed her ladyship. "I remember now."
Her ladyship looked around her for something. "It is there," said Felton, pointing to the bag of gold. They neared the sloop. The seaman on watch hailed the boat, from which an answer was returned.
"What vessel is this?" demanded her ladyship.
"That which I have chartered for you."
"And whither will it take me?"
"Wheresoever you please, after you have landed me at Portsmouth."
"What have you to do at Portsmouth?"
demanded her ladyship. "To execute the orders of Lord de Winter," said Felton, with a gloomy smile.
"What orders?"
inquired her ladyship. "Do you not understand, then?" replied Felton.
"No, explain yourself, I beg of you."
"As he distrusted me, he determined to guard you himself, and has sent me in his stead to procure Buckingham's signature to the order for your transportation."
"But if he suspected you, how came he to entrust you with this order?"
"He supposed me ignorant of its purport, as he had told me nothing respecting it. I had, however, received my information from you."
"True. And you are going to Portsmouth?"
I have no time to lose. Tomorrow is the 23rd, and Buckingham departs on that date with the fleet.
Departs tomorrow? Where is he going?
To La Rochelle.
He must not go,
exclaimed her ladyship, forgetting her habitual presence of mind.
Make yourself easy, answered Felton. He will not go.
Her ladyship trembled with delight. She had just penetrated the most secret depths of the young man's heart, and had there seen the death of Buckingham ineffaceably registered.
Felton, whispered she, you are as great as Judas Maccabeus. Should you die, I shall die with you. I can say no more.
Hush, said Felton. We have reached the vessel. They were, in fact, beside the sloop. Felton ascended the ladder and gave his hand to her ladyship, whilst the sailors supported her, for the sea was still agitated. In a moment afterwards, they were upon the deck. Captain, said Felton, here is the lady of whom I spoke to you. You must take her, safe and sound, to France.
For 1,000 pistoles, replied the captain.
I've already paid you 500 of them.
Right, said the captain.
And here are the other 500, added her ladyship, putting her hand to the bag of gold.
No, said the captain. I have but one word, and that I gave to this young man. The other 500 pistoles are not my due until we make Boulogne.
And shall we make it?
Safe and sound, replied the captain, as sure as my name is Jack Butler.
Well, said her ladyship, if you keep your word instead of 500, I will give you 1,000 pistoles.
Hurrah for you then, my pretty lady, exclaimed the captain, and may fortune often send me such passengers as your ladyship.
In the meantime, said Felton, run into Chichester Bay, just by Portsmouth. You remember that it was agreed you should take us there first? The captain replied by issuing orders for the necessary evolutions, and towards 7 o'clock in the morning, the little vessel hove to in the appointed bay. During this passage, Felton related everything to her ladyship. How, instead of going to London, he had chartered this little vessel. How he had returned. How he had scaled the wall by placing in the interstices of the stones, as he ascended, cramp irons to support his feet. And how at last, having reached the bars of her window, he had secured the ladder to them. Her ladyship was well aware of the remainder. On her side, her ladyship endeavoured to encourage Felton in his design. But at the first words she uttered, she clearly perceived that it was necessary rather to moderate than to excite the young fanatic. It was agreed that her ladyship should wait for Felton until 10 o'clock, and if he should not have returned by that hour, she was to set sail. In the latter case, and supposing him to be afterwards at liberty, he was to rejoin her in France at the Carmelite convent of Béthune. 59. What happened at Portsmouth on the 23rd of August, 1628? Felton took leave of her ladyship, just as a brother who is going out for a mere walk takes leave of his sister by kissing her hand. His whole manners and appearance indicated a state of ordinary tranquillity, except that a strange gleam, like the brilliancy of fever, beamed from his eyes. His forehead was even more calm than usual. His teeth were firmly closed, and his speech had a short and abrupt tone, which seemed to denote that his thoughts were intent upon some gloomy purpose. As long as he remained in the boat which took him ashore, he had kept his face turned towards her ladyship, who, standing on the deck, followed him with her eyes. Neither of them now entertained much fear of being pursued. Her ladyship's apartment was never entered before 9 o'clock in the morning, and it took some hours to travel from the castle to London. Felton set his foot on shore, climbed the rising ground which led to the top of the cliff, saluted her ladyship for the last time, and took his way towards the town. After 100 steps, as the path descended as it proceeded, he could no longer see more than the mast of the vessel. He hastened as fast as possible in the direction of Portsmouth, which, through the morning mist, he could discern in the distance. Beyond the town, the sea was covered with innumerable ships, whose masts, like a forest of poplars stripped of their leaves by winter, were bending before the breath of the wind. During this rapid walk, Felton resolved in his mind all the accusations, whether true or false, with which 10 years of ascetic meditation and a long intercourse with the Puritans had furnished him against the royal favourite. When he compared the public crimes of this minister, crimes which were notorious and, in a manner, European, with those private and unknown vices of which her ladyship had accused him,
Felton found that the most culpable of the two beings whom Buckingham united in himself was the one whose life was hidden from the world. His own love, so singular and fresh and ardent, made him see the infamous and imaginary accusations of her ladyship as one sees through a microscope the form of frightful monsters, atoms of insects otherwise imperceptible. The rapidity of his progress also inflamed his blood. The idea that he left behind him, exposed to a dreadful vengeance, the woman whom he loved, or rather adored as a saint, his past emotions and his present fatigue, all tended to excite and elevate his soul above the feelings of humanity. On entering Portsmouth, he found the whole population astir. The drums were beating in the streets and in the harbour, and the troops about to be embarked were descending towards the sea. Felton arrived at the Admiralty House, covered with dust and wet with perspiration. His usually pale face was purple with heat and anger. The sentinel wished to stop him, but Felton called for the officer on guard and drew from his pocket the letter which he carried. "An express from Lord de Winter," said he. At the name of Lord de Winter, who was known to be one of Buckingham's most intimate friends, the officer gave an order for the admission of Felton, who, moreover, wore the uniform of a naval officer himself. Felton rushed into the house, but the moment he reached the hall, another man also entered, covered with dust and out of breath, having left at the door a post-horse, which, on reaching it, had fallen on its knees. Both individuals addressed Patrick, the Duke's confidential valet, at the same moment. Felton named the Baron de Winter. The stranger refused to mention any name, and declared that he could make himself known to no one but the Duke. Both insisted on being allowed priority of admission. Patrick, who knew that Lord de Winter was connected, both by profession and friendship, with his Grace, gave the preference to him who came in his name. The other was obliged to wait, and it was easy enough to see how heartily he cursed the delay. The valet conducted Felton through a large room, in which were waiting the deputies from La Rochelle, headed by the Prince de Soubise, and introduced him into a cabinet, where Buckingham, having just left the bath, was finishing his toilet, to which, now as ever, he accorded extreme attention. "Lieutenant Felton," said Patrick, "from Lord de Winter."
"From Lord de Winter?" repeated Buckingham. "Show him in."
Felton entered. At this moment Buckingham threw upon a sofa a rich dressing gown brocaded with gold, and put on a doublet of blue velvet, entirely embroidered with pearls.
"Why did the Baron not come himself?" demanded Buckingham. "I expected him this morning."
"He desired me to inform your Grace," replied Felton, "that he very much regretted not having that honour, but that he was prevented by the watch which he is obliged to keep at the castle."
"Oh, yes," said Buckingham. "I know about that. He has a lady prisoner there."
"It is, in fact, about that prisoner that I wish to speak to your Grace," replied Felton.
"Well, proceed."
"What I have to say to you, my lord, must be heard by yourself alone."
"Leave us, Patrick," said Buckingham, "but keep within earshot. I will call you presently."
Patrick left the room.
"We are alone, sir," said Buckingham. "Speak."
"My lord," replied Felton, "the Baron de Winter lately wrote to your Grace requesting you to sign an order for the transportation of a young woman named Charlotte Baxon."
"Yes, sir. And I replied that he should either bring or send me the order, and I would sign it."
"Here it is, my lord."
"Give it to me," said the Duke.
Taking the paper from Felton's hands, his Grace cast a rapid glance over its contents. Then, perceiving it was really that which had been referred to, he laid it on the table, took a pen, and prepared to sign it.
"Pardon me, my lord," said Felton, interrupting the Duke, "but is your Grace aware that Charlotte Baxon is not the real name of this female?"
"Yes, sir, I know that," replied the Duke, dipping his pen into the ink.
"Then your Grace is acquainted with her real name?" demanded Felton, in an abrupt tone.
"I do know it."
The Duke put the pen to the paper. Felton became pale.
"And knowing this real name," resumed Felton, "will your Grace still sign the paper?"
"Certainly," said Buckingham, "and rather twice than once."
"I cannot believe," continued Felton, in a voice which became more and more abrupt and reproachful, "that your Grace is aware that this refers to Lady de Winter."
"I am perfectly aware of it, although I am astonished that you should be."
"And your Grace will sign this order without remorse?"
Buckingham looked haughtily at the speaker.
"Do you happen to know, sir," said he, "that you are asking me some strange questions, and that I am very foolish to answer them?"
"Answer them, my lord," said Felton. "Your position is perhaps more serious than you suppose."
Buckingham thought that as the young man came from Lord de Winter, he probably spoke in his name. He therefore restrained himself. "Without any remorse whatever," said he, "and the Baron knows as well as I do that her ladyship is a great criminal, to whom it is almost a favour to reduce her punishment to transportation." The Duke again put his pen to the paper.
"You shall not sign that order, my lord," said Felton, making a step towards the Duke.
"I shall not sign this order?" exclaimed Buckingham. "And why not?"
"Because you will consult your own conscience, and will render justice to the lady."
"It would be bare justice if she was sent to Tyburn," said the Duke. "Her ladyship is an infamous creature."
"My lord, her ladyship is an angel. You know it well, and I demand her liberty."
"Ah," said Buckingham, "are you mad thus to speak to me?"
"Excuse me, my lord, I speak as I am able. I restrain myself. Yet, my lord, think of what you are about to do. Beware lest the cup should overflow."
"What does he mean? God forgive me!" exclaimed Buckingham. "I verily believe he threatens me."
"No, my lord. I implore you still, and I warn you. One drop of water is sufficient to make the full vase overflow. A slight fault is sufficient to draw down vengeance upon the head which has been spared to this day, in spite of so many crimes."
"Mr. Felton," said Buckingham, "you will leave this room and immediately place yourself under arrest.
And you, my lord, will hear me to the end. You have seduced this young girl. You have violated and polluted her. Repair your crimes towards her. Let her depart freely, and I will exact nothing more of you."
"You will exact nothing more?" cried Buckingham, looking at Felton with astonishment, and dwelling on each syllable of the words which he had just pronounced.
"My lord," continued Felton, becoming more excited as he spoke, "my lord, be careful. The whole of England is wearied by your iniquities. My lord, you have abused the royal power, which you have almost usurped. My lord, you are an abomination to God and man. God will punish you in eternity, and I will punish you now."
"Ah, this is rather too much," exclaimed Buckingham, making a step towards the door. Felton opposed his progress.
"I humbly entreat you," said he, "to sign an order for the liberation of Lady de Winter. Reflect that it is the woman whom you have dishonored."
"Leave the room, sir," said Buckingham, "or I will call my servants to eject you."
"You will not call them," replied Felton, throwing himself between the Duke and the bell, which was placed upon a stand inlaid with silver.
"Take care, my lord, for you are now in God's hands." "In the devil's hands, you mean?" exclaimed Buckingham, elevating his voice so as to attract the attention of those without, without exactly calling them.
"Sign, my lord, sign the liberation of Lady de Winter," said Felton, pushing a paper towards the Duke.
"Under compulsion? You are making a fool of yourself. Hello there, Patrick!"
"Sign, my lord."
"Never."
"Never?"
"Help!" cried the Duke, at the same time leaping towards his sword.
But Felton did not give him time to draw it. The open knife with which her ladyship had wounded herself was concealed under his doublet, and in one bound he was upon the Duke. At that same moment Patrick entered the room, exclaiming,
"My lord, a letter from France!"
"From France?" cried Buckingham, forgetting everything as he imagined from whom that letter came. Felton took advantage of the moment and buried the knife up to its handle in the Duke's side.
"Ah, traitor!" exclaimed Buckingham. "Thou hast slain me!"
"Murder!"
shouted Patrick. Felton cast his eyes around, and seeing the door free, he rushed into the adjoining room, where, as we have said, the deputies from La Rochelle were waiting, passed through it still running, and hurried towards the staircase. But upon the first step he met Lord de Winter, who, on seeing him wild-looking and livid, and with blood upon his hands and face, rushed upon him and exclaimed,
"I knew it! I foresaw it! 1 minute too late! Alas! Alas! How unfortunate is my lot!"
Felton did not attempt to resist, and Lord de Winter handed him over to the guards, who, in the meantime, conducted him to a little terrace overlooking the sea.
his lordship himself hastened into Buckingham's cabinet. On hearing the Duke's cry and Patrick's shout, the man whom Felton had met in the antechamber rushed into his Grace's room. He found the Duke reclining on a sofa, pressing the wound with his convulsed hand.
"Laporte," said the Duke in a dying voice. "Laporte, do you come from her?"
"Yes, Your Grace," replied the faithful servant of Anne of Austria. "But I fear I come too late."
"Hush, Laporte, you might be overheard. Patrick, let no one enter. Oh, I shall not know what she says to me. My God, I am dying!"
The Duke fainted. Nevertheless, Lord de Winter, the deputies, the chiefs of the expedition, and the officers of Buckingham's household had already forced their way into the room. Cries of despair resounded on every side. The tidings which had filled the house with lamentation and groans soon spread and became generally known throughout the town, whilst the report of a cannon announced that something new and unexpected had occurred. Lord de Winter tore his hair.
"One minute too late!" exclaimed he. "One minute too late! Oh, my God, what a misfortune!"
He had, in fact, at 7 o'clock in the morning, received information that a rope ladder had been found suspended from one of the windows of the castle, and instantly hastening to her ladyship's chamber, he had found it empty, the window open, and the bars filed through. Remembering then the verbal warning which D'Artagnan had sent to him by his messenger, he had trembled for the Duke, and without a moment's delay he had mounted the first horse available and galloped at full speed to Portsmouth, dismounting in the courtyard, and hastily ascended the staircase where, as we have already said, he encountered Felton on the topmost step. But the Duke was not yet dead. He recovered his senses, again unclosed his eyes, and hope revived in all their hearts.
"Gentlemen," said he, "leave me alone with Patrick and Laporte." "Ah, it is you, de Winter. You sent me a strange madman this morning. See what he has done to me." "Oh, my lord," exclaimed the baron. "Oh, my lord, never shall I forgive myself for it." "And there you would be wrong, de Winter," said Buckingham, giving him his hand. "I know not any man who is worthy to be regretted by another throughout the whole of his life. But leave us, I beseech you."
The baron left the room, sobbing. There remained in the cabinet only the wounded Duke, Laporte, and Patrick. A surgeon had been summoned, but could not be found.
"You will live, my lord, you will live,"
repeated the messenger of Anne of Austria, kneeling before the Duke.
"What has she written to me?"
said Buckingham feebly, as the blood gushed from him, and he subdued, in order to speak of her he loved, his enormous pains.
"What has she written to me? Read me her letter." "Oh, my lord!" exclaimed Laporte. "Well, Laporte, do you not see that I have no time to lose?"
Laporte instantly broke the seal, and held the parchment before the Duke's eyes, but Buckingham in vain attempted to decipher the writing.
"Read it, then," said he. "Read it. Read quickly, for I can no longer see. Read it, for I shall soon be no longer able to hear, and shall die without knowing what she has written to me."
Laporte no longer hesitated. The letter was as follows.
"My lord, by all that I have suffered through you, and for you since I have known you, I conjure you, if you have any regard to my repose, to put an end to those vast preparations which you are making against France, and to relinquish a war of which it is openly said, religion is the avowed and your love of me the secret cause. That war may not only bring great calamities on France and England, but even upon yourself, my lord, misfortunes for which I could never be consoled. Be careful of your own life, which is threatened, and which will be dear to me from the moment when I shall no longer be obliged to consider you an enemy. Yours affectionately, Anne."
Buckingham roused all his fast-failing energies to listen to this letter, and when it was ended, as if he had experienced a bitter disappointment,
"And have you nothing more to tell me? No verbal message, Laporte?" demanded he. "Yes, my lord. The queen charged me to bid you be upon your guard, for she had been warned that you were to be assassinated." "And is that all? Is that all?"
resumed Buckingham impatiently.
She charged me also to tell you that she always loved you."
"Ah," said Buckingham, "God be praised. My death, then, will not be to her as the death of a stranger." "Patrick," continued the Duke, "bring me the casket which contained the diamond stud."
Patrick brought the object he demanded, which Laporte recognized as having belonged to the Queen.
"Now, the white satin bag, on which her initials are embroidered in pearls."
Patrick again obeyed.
"Here, Laporte," said Buckingham, "here are the only tokens which I have received from her. This silver casket and these two letters. You will restore them to Her Majesty. And for a last souvenir,"
he looked around him for some precious object,
"you will add to them."
He still strove to find some gift, but his eyes, dimmed by death, encountered nothing but the knife which had fallen from Felton's hand, with the crimson blood still reeking on its blade.
"And you will add to them this knife,"
said the Duke, pressing Laporte's hand. He was still able to place the satin bag in the casket, and to drop the knife upon it, as he made a sign to Laporte that he could no longer speak. Then, in a last convulsion, against which he was no longer able to contend, he glided from the sofa to the floor. Patrick uttered a loud cry. Buckingham endeavoured to smile once more, but death arrested the thought, which remained engraven on his forehead and lips, like a last farewell of love. At this moment the Duke's surgeon arrived, completely bewildered. He had already been on board the Admiral's ship, whence he had been so hastily summoned. He approached the Duke, took his hand, held it for a moment in his own, and then let it fall again.
"It is all in vain," said he. "He is dead." "Dead! Dead!"
echoed Patrick. At this cry the whole crowd re-entered the apartment, and there was nothing to be seen but consternation and confusion. As soon as Lord de Winter knew that Buckingham had expired, he ran to Felton, whom the soldiers still guarded on the terrace.
"Wretch!"
said he to the young man, who, since Buckingham's death, had recovered that tranquillity and coolness which were never more to abandon him.
"Wretch! What have you done?"
"I have avenged myself," he replied.
"Yourself!" cried the Baron. "Say rather that you have been the instrument of that cursed woman! But I swear to you that it shall be her last crime."
"I do not know what you mean," replied Felton calmly, "and I am quite ignorant of what woman you are speaking, my lord. I have killed the Duke of Buckingham because he twice refused to make me a captain at your request. I have punished him for his injustice, for no other reason."
De Winter looked, in his astonishment, at the men who were binding Felton, and knew not what to think of such insensibility. One single idea, however, still left a cloud upon Felton's brow. At every step that he heard, the simple Puritan thought he recognized the step and voice of her ladyship, who had come to throw herself into his arms, to accuse herself and to perish with him. Suddenly he started. His glance was fixed upon a point on the sea, which the terrace where he stood completely overlooked. With the eagle eye of a sailor, he had discovered there, where another could only have seen a speck upon the ocean, the sail of a sloop which was bearing on towards the shores of France. He grew pale, pressed his hand upon his heart, which was bursting, and at once comprehended the whole extent of the treachery.
"Grant me one last favour," said he to the Baron.
"What is it?" demanded the latter.
"What time is it?"
The Baron drew out his watch.
"It wants 9:10,
said he. Her ladyship, then, had anticipated the time of her departure by an hour and a half. As soon as she heard the cannon which announced the fatal event, she had ordered the anchor to be weighed. The boat was now visible under a blue sky, at a great distance from the shore.
"It was God's will," said Felton, with the resignation of a fatalist, but still unable to tear his eyes from that bark, on board of which he doubtless believed that he could distinguish the fair vision of her for whom he was about to sacrifice his life. De Winter followed his glances, scrutinized his emotions, and comprehended all that had occurred.
"Be punished alone, wretch, in the first place," said his lordship to Felton,
who allowed himself to be dragged away, with his eyes still turned towards the sea.
But I swear to you, by the memory of my brother, whom I so truly loved, that your accomplice is not saved."
Felton held down his head without uttering a word. As for De Winter, he hastily descended the stairs and betook himself to the harbor. 60. In France. The first apprehension of the King of England, Charles I, on hearing of the Duke of Buckingham's death, was, lest intelligence so terrible might discourage the Rochellois. Hence he endeavored, says Richelieu in his memoirs, to conceal it from them as long as possible.
This is the end of disc number 18. Please insert disc number 19. This is disc number 19.
Sixty. In France. The first apprehension of the King of England, Charles I, on hearing of the Duke of Buckingham's death, was, lest intelligence so terrible might discourage the Rochellois. Hence he endeavored, says Richelieu in his memoirs, to conceal it from them as long as possible, closing all the ports of his kingdom, and being scrupulously careful that no vessel should leave until after the departure of the army which Buckingham had been preparing, and whose embarkation he now undertook to superintend in person. He even enforced this order with so much strictness as to detain in England the Danish ambassador, who had already taken leave, and the ambassador from Holland, who was to take back into Flushing those Dutch Indiamen whose restitution Charles had procured. But as the king had not thought of issuing this order until 5 hours after the event, two ships had already left the port, one bearing, as we know, her ladyship, who, already suspecting what had happened, was confirmed in her belief by seeing the black flag unfolding itself from the mast of the admiral's ship. As for the second vessel, we shall hereafter be told whom it carried and how it got away. During this interval, nothing extraordinary had occurred at the camp before La Rochelle, except that the king, who was, as usual, bored, and perhaps more so at the camp than elsewhere, resolved to go incognito to enjoy the fêtes of Saint Louis at Saint-Germain, and requested the cardinal to provide for him an escort of 20 musketeers. The cardinal, who sometimes was wearied by the gloominess of the king, willingly gave this leave of absence to his royal lieutenant, who promised to return by the 12th of September. When Monsieur de Treville was informed of this journey by his eminence, he prepared his baggage, and as, without knowing the cause, he was fully aware of the earnest desire, or rather the imperious necessity, that the four friends had for visiting Paris, he marked them out as part of the escort. The four young men received the intelligence a quarter of an hour after Monsieur de Treville, as they were the very first persons to whom he communicated it. And then it was that D'Artagnan fully appreciated the favour which the cardinal had conferred upon him in promoting him to the musketeers, since, but for that circumstance, he would have been compelled to remain at the camp whilst his companions departed. It will be seen hereafter that his anxiety to return to Paris was occasioned by the danger which Madame Bonancieux was likely to incur from encountering her mortal enemy, Lady de Winter, at the convent of Béthune. Thus, as we have said, Aramis had written immediately to Marie Michon, that seamstress of Tours, who had such exalted acquaintances, that she might solicit from the queen an order empowering Madame Bonancieux to leave the convent and to take refuge either in Lorraine or Belgium. The answer was not long delayed, for in 8 or 10 days Aramis had received this letter. "My dear cousin, I send the order empowering our little servant to withdraw from the convent of Béthune, where you think that the heir does not agree with her. My sister sends you this order with great pleasure, for she is much attached to this little girl, whom she hopes to benefit in the end. I embrace you, Marie Michon." To this letter was appended an order in these terms: "The superior of the convent of Béthune will deliver into the hands of the bearer of this note the novice who entered her convent under my recommendation and patronage. Anne. At the Louvre, August 10, 1628. It may well be imagined how much this relationship between Aramis and a seamstress at Tours, who called the queen her sister, enlivened the young men. But Aramis, after having two or three times blushed up to the whites of his eyes at the coarse jokes of Porthos, had begged his friends not to revert to the subject, declaring that if another word were said about it, he would not again employ his cousin as an agent in affairs of the kind. So nothing more about Marie Michon was said between the four musketeers, who had, moreover, obtained what they wanted, the order to withdraw Madame Bonancieux from the convent of Béthune. It is true that this order would be of no great advantage to them, whilst they continued in the camp at La Rochelle, that is to say, at the other extremity of France. D'Artagnan was about to ask leave of absence from Monsieur de Tréville, plainly confiding to him how important it was that he should depart, when the intelligence reached him, as well as his three companions, that the king was about to proceed to Paris with an escort of 20 musketeers, of which they were to form a part. Great was their joy. Their servants were sent forward with the baggage, and they themselves set out in the morning of the 16th. The cardinal attended the king from Surgères to Meuse, where the king and his minister took leave of each other with great professions of friendship. Nevertheless, the king, although he travelled very fast, since he wished to reach Paris by the 23rd, was so anxious for amusement that he halted from time to time to hunt the magpie, a pastime for which he had acquired a taste from Deligne, the first husband of Madame de Chevreuse, and for which he had always preserved a great liking. 16 of the 20 musketeers much enjoyed this sport when it occurred, but 4 of them cursed it most heartily. D'Artagnan, more especially, had a perpetual humming in his ears, which Porthos thus explained. "A woman of the highest rank assured me that it is a sign that someone is talking about you somewhere." On the night of the 23rd, the escort at length passed through Paris. The king thanked Monsieur de Tréville and allowed him to grant 4 days' leave of absence to his men, on condition that not one of the favoured individuals should appear at any public place under pain of the Bastille. The first 4 leaves were granted, as may be imagined, to our 4 friends, and more than that, Athos persuaded Monsieur de Tréville to extend it to 6 days instead of 4, and managed to cram 2 more nights into these 6 days, for they set off on the 24th at 5 o'clock in the evening, and Monsieur de Tréville had the complaisance to post-date the leave to the morning of the 25th. "Oh, mon Dieu!" said D'Artagnan, who, as we are well aware, never foresaw difficulty. "It appears to me that we are making a great disturbance about a very simple matter. In 2 days, by foundering 2 or 3 horses, which I should not care about, since I have plenty of money, I could be at Béthune. I should then deliver the queen's letter to the abbess, and could bring back the dear treasure which I am seeking, not to Lorraine, not to Belgium, but to Paris, where she might be much more securely concealed, particularly whilst the cardinal remains at La Rochelle. Then, when the campaign is once ended, partly from the protection of her cousin and partly from what we have ourselves personally done for her, we shall obtain from the queen whatever we desire. Remain, therefore, here. Do not fatigue yourselves uselessly. I and Planchet shall be quite sufficient for so simple an expedition." To this, Athos quietly replied, "And we also have got some money. For I have not yet quite drunk the remains of the diamond, and Porthos and Aramis have not quite eaten them up. So we may as well founder 4 horses as 1. But remember, D'Artagnan," he added, in a voice so sad that his accent made the young man shudder, "remember that Béthune is a town where the cardinal has made an appointment with a woman who, wherever she goes, brings misfortune with her. If you had only 4 men to deal with, D'Artagnan, I should let you go alone. But you have to deal with this woman, so let all 4 of us go, and God grant that, with our 4 valets, we may be in sufficient number." "You quite terrify me, Athos," exclaimed D'Artagnan. "What, then, do you dread?" "Everything," replied Athos. D'Artagnan looked into the countenances of his companions, which, like that of Athos, bore the impress of profound anxiety, and they continued their journey at the utmost speed of their horses, but without uttering another word. On the evening of the 26th, as they were entering Arras, and just as D'Artagnan had dismounted at the tavern of the Golden Harrow to drink a glass of wine, a cavalier came out of the yard of the change-house, where he had just changed his horse, and proceeded at full gallop on the road to Paris. At the moment that he issued from the great gate into the street, the wind opened the cloak in which he was wrapped, although it was the month of August, and lifted up his hat, which he caught and pushed violently down upon his forehead. D'Artagnan, whose looks were fixed upon this man, turned very pale and let fall his glass.
"What is the matter, sir?" cried Planchet. "Oh, here, here! Make haste, gentlemen! My master's ill!"
The three friends hastened in,